Want to hear one of my favorite sounds? That's the sound I hear when I get one of the questions right on Babbel. And if you want to learn a new language this year, I guarantee it'll be one of your favorite sounds too. I've been saying I wanted to learn another language for the longest time now, and I'm finally doing it this year with Babbel. I signed up for French because there's a lot of medical history that I'm interested in that was originally written in French. Plus, I've always wanted to travel to France, and when I finally get there, I'd like to be able to get around. Now, Babbel's tips and tools are approachable, accessible, and they're rooted in real-life situations delivered with conversation-based teaching, so you're ready to practice what you've learned in the real world. I actually recorded my first lesson in French. Here, take a listen. Matching au revoir to goodbye.
Au revoir.
Au revoir. When will I get the cool accent?
Bonjour.
All right. Got it. Now, that's just my first lesson, so don't judge me or my accent. But I did pick up on a few things that I thought were interesting. There's a lot of spaced repetition and cognitive flexibility being used in their lessons, and I've been pretty impressed so far with the program. The app and regular website are both super easy to use and look great, and the lessons can be done in 10 minutes or less. So far, I feel like I'm learning a lot, and we have a very special deal for our listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, babbel.com/barbellpod. That's BABBEL.com/barbellpod. There's rules and restrictions may apply, but 60% off. Check them out, guys.
A new year, time for new growth. Grow your education and skills with Herzing University. Our online behavioral health programs fit your schedule and time. From an 8-month diploma program in health and human services to a 36-month bachelor's in psychology. Grow your behavioral health career with us wherever you are in your education. Your future starts now at Herzing University. Visit us online at herzing.edu or text health to 85109. Online at herzing.edu or text health to 85109.
It's the Barbell Medicine Podcast, where we bring modern medicine to strength and conditioning and strength and conditioning to modern medicine. I'm your host, Dr. Jordan Feigenbaum, joined by the second most handsome doctor in North America, Dr. Austin Baraki. What's going on, man?
Hey, man. I'm here. Doing all right. What's up with you?
He says he's all right. He says it. We'll find out. This is episode 199. This is our new November 2022 research review, which, as the name implies, is where we review some breaking research. All of these papers, I think, are from they're from this month, which is wild.
That's cool.
But you know how it works. It's like they get published online, and they say they're published like in the future. Like, you sent me multiple papers that were published the day after you sent them, and I'm like, guys, just chronologically, this makes no sense. That makes me suspect of your peer review process, your publication process. But yeah, all of these are from November, so we're going to talk about everything from mushrooms, or no, as the youths call them, shrooms, or do they call them boomers?
Have you ever heard that?
Man. not in this. Oh my gosh. Okay. This is an aside. When I was doing my ED, rotation, in residency, if we were discharging a patient and they needed to pick up a prescription, but they didn't have insurance, we would always try to, you know, hook them up with a GoodRx coupon, or at least tell them about that, because usually you can get some discounts. This podcast is not sponsored by GoodRx, but that's just a cool thing, that like service that they offer for free. There was a different website called StreetRx, and basically it would like identify individuals who had street drugs that were willing to sell them to you. And apparently this was very, very popular in Los Angeles when I was there.
How did this come to your attention? Is the next question.
The ED does. Yeah, because he was like, yeah, I see you're using GoodRx. That's good. Have you ever heard of StreetRx? And I was like, no. He's like, yeah, I've had some patients come in from that. I'm like, oh, interesting. This is not an endorsement for either GoodRx or StreetRx, I should just say. So we're going to talk about some psilocybin. We're going to talk about some dietary supplements for dyslipidemia, high cholesterol, and we're going to talk about the Baraki exertion scale. Now, if you don't know what the Baraki exertion scale is, this was a April Fool's blog post I put up. What do you think? That's like 6 years ago now.
Has it been that long?
I mean, I think it was 2017. So that's, you know, it'll be 6 years next April. Basically, when Baraki lifts heavy, his eyeballs pop out of the sockets.
2018.
That's 2018. All right. So don't want to date ourselves here. But basically, when Baraki lifts heavy, his eyeballs pop out of the socket. And so, you know, his facial contortion was the proxy for RPE. And we kind of got a similar thing here. So we'll talk about that. Talk about some eye stuff. And but anyway, before we get into that, everything going okay? You're doing doctor stuff.
I'm doing real doctor stuff, as we say. Wrapping up 2 weeks in the hospital in about two more days. So then I'll get a little bit of a stretch off. So I've had a lot of good patient encounters, a ton of good teaching with my team and my students, and things are going okay with them at the moment. Yeah.
Yeah. I always wonder, like, okay, so during these 2 week stretches, would you rather have like a super busy service, you know, like quite a bit of turnover? So, you know, admitting, discharging, a lot of learning, a lot of teaching, but not like the cases are, I would say, relatively straightforward because you can identify them, treat them, manage, and then, you know, discharge? Or would you want relatively light on the admissions and light on the discharge because you have more either complicated patients or the dispo is difficult, or which scenario would you prefer?
I mean, I feel like I've had experience with a ton of them. I mean, where I trained in residency was kind of a regular county hospital unit affiliated with the university system in San Antonio. And that place was effectively a madhouse with how busy it was all the time. All of our residency teams were packed to the max every day, constant discharging and admitting all the time. And it made it so that we had a ton of kind of experiential learning and on the job learning and training, but less time for effective kind of like didactic teaching from our staff and our mentors and things like that. And then where I moved for my first job after that in San Antonio was a much lighter kind of volume, like a moderate volume place. It was not quite as busy. And I had a bunch more time to teach, but it was still like a major medical center within the military system. So we had plenty of complex cases and things like that. So that was a nice balance. And where I am now in El Paso is probably an even slightly lower volume place. And so I have a bit more time to teach. And so at the moment, I mean, I have a variation on my team right now of some patients who've been there for, you know, a week or two, and then a bunch who are there for a couple days, and then most who are there for, you know, a day or 2 days or something. We can get them quickly, you know, get their issue addressed pretty quickly and get them turned around and on their way. So I think that, you know, there's no substitute for experiencing all of those things. And I think that the dose of volume, I guess, that these that I deal with on a day-to-day basis here is lower than I have in the past. And it just affords me more time to do what I actually like to do, which is more of the teaching aspect with the trainees. So,
yeah, I wonder. So, when do you guys usually finish rounds? Because this is always how I would rate my attending, like when rounds were finished.
Yeah,
because, you know, we would show up at the crack of dawn, right, pre-round, and then you round with the other residents,
yeah,
the other, you know, for turnover, and then you're rounding with the attending at some point later. And if we could wrap it up by lunchtime, so we could like do the work, you know, get everybody nice and tucked in. So
yeah,
that was great. But if it's like, oh, let's take lunch and then come back.
Definitely
oh
not.
Oh boy. Oh boy.
I don't ever do that. Most days on average, I start at 8:30. If things are super busy, super slammed, or if I need to get my team out for the day, let's send them home, then I will show up a little earlier and start earlier. And so basically the busier things are, or the earlier I need to get my team out, the earlier I'll show up and start, as early as 7 or 7:30, but that's pretty uncommon. So most days is 8:30 start. And then I pretty much have things wrapped up usually by 10:30. If things are particularly busy, then it might go a little bit later. But usually what I'll do is I'll hit the high points with my team and say, go do what you got to do. And then I'll see the rest of the folks myself. So I'm never keeping them all the way until noon, or definitely not past noon, because I know what that's like, and not cool. So, I mean, we had a pretty good day last week where we had, I think we started, it wasn't a crazy busy day, but we started at, I don't know, 7:30 or something. We had 13 folks to see, and we saw all of them and discharged six or seven of them and had the team done and out by like 11 or 11:30, which was like a pretty good day for them. So.
All right. Last question related to rounding.
Okay.
I'm just curious on your experience. What rotation during your training at any point had the longest rounds?
I mean, I think it probably had to be probably some of the internal medicine, depending on who I was working with. I don't know. What do you think?
Yeah, I is either toss up for my pediatric rotation in med school. I was like, it was like neurosurge, room, and like there's four total specialties I recall, but I don't remember the other two, but they were like pretty complex stuff. And it's just like, if you're admitted to the service, We got a lot to talk about. Either that or the ICU at some point, even though the acuity is higher and you're trying to like figure out, all right, what are we doing? Yeah. What are we doing? It's just the severity was high and you're just like, it's going to take
each patient takes a while when like six different organ systems are failing. So
yeah. Plus the actual reporting, like I feel for whoever the attendings or senior residents were that I was presenting to. And I'm just like, okay, we're going to start with this system and go through. And they're like, oh no, come on, let's go Feigenbaum. I'm like, I don't know what I'm doing. Anyway, yeah, all right. Well, cool. Training's going okay. You just said you just got out of the pool.
Yep. I lifted after I got back from work, did some light sumo pulls for sets of 10, and then went over to the pool. So,
yeah, nice. I am in full bodybuilding mode. And let me tell you, I have had some unique DOMs in places that normally never been sore.
New to you.
Yeah, I'm like, what is this distal aspect of my quadriceps that I've never known existed before? Or I did my first set of calf raises in my life last week, and I've done them twice since. Okay, one, what a stupid exercise. Just like and me filming them, I'm like, oh yeah, the dudes are gonna go crazy for this. But like yeah, calves were sore. And you know, it's like when you stretch in bed, you like lay down and you're like, and I was actively not doing it because I was afraid of getting a cramp of some sort.
Yeah, you give yourself Charlie horses with those.
Yeah, and I'm like, no, I don't have anybody to help me. So yeah, but you know, the good news is some great YouTube content coming out on training vlogs. I've got my adductor rehab stuff, that's all done and dusted, so that'll be up soon. The shoulder rehab from the dislocation in February. My meat prep for the meat that I did in May, plus some bodybuilding stuff. Got all that. The podcasts we're uploading those. So you guys are going to see Austin's post-swim hair, which is it's a good look. It's like California beach hair, but you're not in California. So yeah, you got that. We just need to put some sun in your hair, I think.
It's not as dead and silvery as it used to be.
Wait, do you put a swim cap on when you go swimming?
Not these days, no.
No. But if you were getting more serious,
if I was going to race, then yes, I would for sure.
Yeah, I just feel, okay, what if your hair was a little longer though? Do you think you would just do it because your hair would be in the way or just be annoying?
Yeah, okay. Exactly.
I just, put the swim, that was my least favorite part of swimming. Putting the swim cap on, and then you're just like, and you feel like your head's being squeezed out in like any part of that. Helmet, no problem. Swim cap, no, not for me. So yeah, we got a bunch of YouTube stuff up. So just search Barbell Medicine on YouTube. You can check that out. We've got seminars, live in-person seminars coming up. We got one this weekend. We have one spot left in Los Angeles. We're otherwise sold out for Los Angeles. So if you're in the Los Angeles, Southern California area, or can be this weekend, and you're like, man, these two guys sound like some people I'd like to learn from, and you want to get some coaching, plus you want to meet Alan Thrall, Leah Lutz, Tom Capitelli. We're all going to be at the seminar this weekend, and a bunch of other a bunch of our other staff's going to be there too. Other live in-person seminars, the new, brand new and improved pain and rehab seminar is in Miami in January. Dr. Baraki and I will also be there hanging out. So if you're on the fence about going to that seminar, can confirm we will be there, should be a good time. And they will also have additional 2-day health and performance seminars in Atlanta and New York in 2023. So all of that is linked in the description below. Okay, I think it is time now to get into this week's podcast. Again, this is episode 199. I'm with Dr. Austin Baraki. This is the November 2022 research review. First up, bombshell of a paper, bombshell. The title of the paper is Single Dose Psilocybin for Treatment-Resistant Episode of Major Depression. This is by Goodwin et al. And a very large research group across the globe. This was published in the November 2022 edition of the New England Journal of Medicine. Did you look at the author list here?
Uh-oh. Uh-oh.
All right. You got a waveform?
Yeah. I think I'm back now.
Okay, cool. Did you look at the author list here?
I mean, I have it up in front of me. It is a, Yeah. I mean, a lot of the big New England Journal papers tend to have a lot of authors, but this is even for that. It's on the high side.
This looked to me like a clinical practice guideline. It's like you got, I mean, I don't know the exact number, but at least 30 authors.
Yeah.
So I was like, oh, I wonder where this came from. And it's all over the globe. So pretty interesting.
Which is pretty interesting given that there were, you know, the actual number of patients in the study. It was decent size, but not like, you know, multiple tens of thousands of patients or something like that.
No. But this is a phase two clinical trial. This was funded by industry. We'll talk about who funded it and kind of what they did. But first, just kind of a little background on what is treatment-resistant major depressive episode. So a major depressive episode, just in and of itself, versus other depression subtypes, is diagnosed in individuals that have five or more of the following symptoms for at least two consecutive weeks, and it's not clearly attributable to another medical condition or in the context of like substance use. And at least one of the symptoms has to be depressed mood or loss of interest, which is also known as anhedonia. So they need to have either depressed mood or loss of interest, and at least four of these other things. So significant weight loss, which is about 5% or more in a month, or decrease in appetite on most days, insomnia or hypersomnia, which is just sleeping a lot nearly every day, restlessness or slow movements nearly every day, fatigue or loss of energy, again, nearly every day, feelings of worthlessness or guilt nearly every day, diminished ability to think or concentrate nearly every day, and or recurrent thoughts of death, suicidal ideation, or a suicide attempt. So that's kind of how we diagnose a major depressive episode. And generally, when people get diagnosed with this, we initiate treatment. This is a really common issue, just major depressive episodes. Depression is common with about 5% of the population experiencing depression over a year. That's globally. In the US and Europe, it's about 10% over a year with a lifetime prevalence of 21%. So again, very common. As far as what makes something a treatment-resistant episode of major depressive episode, basically there's no firm definition, but most authors will define this as trying at least two agents in monotherapy, which basically means you're just taking one medication, and it not adequately treating these symptoms. Just as an additional background, we know that resistance training reduces the symptoms and that it doesn't seem to matter whether strength ultimately improves as a result of training, suggesting some independent mechanism of benefit outside of just getting stronger. However, exercise in all the studies that it's basically used to see what its effect is on a major depressive episode is not used as monotherapy, meaning that they're not comparing like, oh yeah, just go train and get stronger. Versus, you know, take an SSRI or other sort of medication. But yeah, usually as an adjunct treatment, it seems to have some benefit. In any case, again, this treatment-resistant episode of major depression basically means they tried two medications separately and it did not work. And then in this particular study, these folks had a pretty persistent episode of major depression that was just treatment-resistant for a long period of time. So let's talk about the actual study. Again, this is a phase two clinical trials funded by industry. So the company is called Compass Pathfinder. They're a company trying to develop psilocybin therapy for treatment-resistant depression. As far as what is a phase two clinical trial, these typically recruit a small number of patients to assess safety. They also do that in phase one clinical trials, but it's a little bit bigger in phase two. So they're trying to assess safety. They're also trying to find the correct dose for efficacy, see if it actually affects the disease they're trying to treat, and also study how the drug is metabolized and stuff like that so they can move on to phase three clinical trials, which again, they either compare to another medication or a placebo or something like that and so on down the line. So let's talk about what psilocybin is for a second. So this is a serotonergic psychedelic drug derived from mushrooms. Serotonergic means that it causes an increase in serotonin to be released from various serotonin-releasing nerves. And psychedelic basically means mind. Psych basically means mind, and then manifesting means that's where delic kind of comes from, implying that psychedelics can expand the mind. This was actually coined by a researcher. I think it was Orman in the 50s. And yeah, nobody's like gone back to think, hey, maybe we should rename this or like define what the word actually is. But yeah, can cause like hallucinogenic sort of experiences. And so it qualifies as a psychedelic, even though the word itself is not really well defined. So the proposed mechanism based on functional MRI data of psilocybin, basically shows decreased blood flow to the amygdala. That's a small area of the brain that is involved in memories, emotions, experiences, things
threat,
of that nature.
Threat perception and things like that.
All too. Sorts of stuff. Yeah. So we talk about pain, you know, mediation, modulation, pain experience. The amygdala is heavily involved in that. We talk about fear. Amygdala is heavily involved in that. So decreased blood flow to the amygdala, altered brain circuit connectivity, and so on, that basically disrupts the circuits in the brain underlying maladaptive thoughts of guilt and ruminations about one's inadequacy. And that is a direct quote from like the proposed mechanism of action of psilocybin paper. Link that obviously in the description below as well. Now, I don't want people to think about this like, oh, just it's your brain anatomy that's messed up or your brain function that's messed up. And we just, you know, alter the blood flow and bada bing, bada boom, depression cured. So I don't want to reduce it down to that. Just like the SSRIs, when we talked about that paper, you know, when they showed that, you know, the serotonin levels didn't necessarily change that much. Yeah, well, let's not reduce depression down to like a serotonin deficiency, for example. As far as previous data on this, there are 3 trials in humans basically showing efficacy of psilocybin on major depressive disorder. Small patient groups, one of the studies, they combined it with, I think it was citalopram. Another study was in individuals with cancer who had depression. Again, small sample size, and I don't remember the third paper off the top of my head, but again, pretty small sample sizes. So this paper was actually a much larger sample size, so number of subjects enrolled. And the unique feature of this was also that it was treatment resistant major depressive disorder rather than just run of the mill major depressive episode. So there were 22 clinical sites involved in the study in 10 different countries, and they enrolled 233 patients with treatment-resistant major depression. They were randomized into 1 of 3 arms. One of the treatment arms got 25 milligrams of psilocybin. Another group got 10 milligrams of psilocybin, and the other group, the control group, got 1 milligram of psilocybin. Now, Austin, when you sent me the paper originally, I was like, no control? And you're like, well, the 1 milligram psilocybin group was the control. Why would they do something like that?
Yeah, it's challenging to, if you think about the quote unquote gold standard for most pharmaceutical like drug trials, it is this idea of like a blinded placebo controlled trial where the patients and preferably the researchers as well don't know which patient got what. But as you can imagine, it can be rather tricky to give a completely inert kind of placebo to patients in this kind of a trial, because they will very rapidly figure out that they did not in fact get the psychedelic kind of drug. Now, of course, even, you know, they use this 1 milligram dose, and it may have had a little bit of an impact on some patients. And we'll talk about some of the limitations of this, you know, paper when we get towards the end. But the idea was that it's low enough that, you know, it would effectively serve as a control in this situation. And perhaps they might feel a little bit of some tingles or something like that, yeah, such that it's not immediate unblinding of like, oh, I realized that I didn't actually get, you know, the study drug. And then you kind of effectively figure out, you unblind yourself and then you figure it out. And then your outcomes are, you know, worsened because you're not actually blinded.
Yeah. Like you said, they could have used an antihistamine or some other sort of medication.
Yeah, there are trials that use so-called active placebos. And so that is a concept where, like, say you're using something, you're studying a drug that provides some sort of like, you know, effect, be it on your cognition or makes you feel a certain way or something like that. They will use a different medicine that works by a completely different mechanism independent of the one that you're studying that will have some kind of effect, right? So if it's like, you know, a medicine that's intended to relieve anxiety, and then they'll give, you know, that the study drug, and then they'll give something else that works by a completely different way that may have some, you know, potential feelings like that as a result, so that you still are remain blinded to whether you got the actual drug, and then they can kind of have a little bit more rigor to it that way. So that's kind of the idea with kind of active controls or active placebos.
Yep. So those were the 3 arms that the 233 patients got randomized into. All of these patients got 1 dose and then were basically kept in the clinical setting for 6 to 8 hours while they went on their journey. This was led by a therapist and an assistant therapist. They had a specialized playlist, which I could not find the contents of the specialized playlist, but they made sure the authors made sure that we knew this was not just, you know, somebody's Spotify playlist called like Short and Thick or something like that. It was a special playlist, and they also used eye shades so that the subjects did not perseverate or focus on any one thing via visual stimuli. So yeah, at baseline, none of the patients could be on any treatment for depression, but if throughout this sort of, it was a 12-week long trial, they could be started on other medications for depression during that time. The average age of the participant was about 40, 39.8 years old. Half approximately were female and half were male. 92% were white. And the average current depressive episode was greater than a year. So basically, these folks had been seen, managed, treated for depression, but inadequately, or basically did not work, and that the current episode was lasting for greater than a year. As far as to assess outcomes, they used what's called a Montgomery-Åsberg Depression Rating Scale, the MADRS score. This is a 10-question questionnaire about feelings, thoughts, function, et cetera, and each question is rated 0 to 6 points. 0 points basically being quote unquote normal or better without depression, for example, and 6 would indicate greater impact of depression. That was their primary endpoint. They did this MADRS evaluation at weeks 1, 3, 6, 9, and 12 at the end of the study duration. They had some secondary endpoints as well. Basically, they were looking for, can we get at least a 50% decrease in the MADRS score from baseline to week 3? Can we keep that? That sort of reduction, they would call that remission, with a MADRS score less than 10. So that would be like a quote unquote normal score. And then was it sustained? So basically, did they sustain that throughout the entire study period all the way to week 12? So what happened? All right. So at baseline, the depression was moderate. The average MADRS score was 20 to 30 and about a third of the patients, and greater than 30 in about two-thirds of the patients. But basically, this was similar across all of the arms. So the folks getting 25 milligrams, 10 milligrams, and 1 milligram, basically no differences between groups. As far as the maybe a confounding variable as far as how many of the folks got initiated on additional treatment for depression, about 33% of the 25 milligram group started treatment for depression within the study period. 24% in the 10 milligram group started an additional treatment for depression during the study period. And then 20% of the 1 milligram control group started an additional treatment for depression in the 12-week study period. All right. And so the results: out of 79 individuals in the 25 milligram group, 37% saw a response, and 29% had remission at week 3. In the 10 milligram group, 19% saw a response and 9% had remission in their symptoms by week 3. Again, that's an MADRS score less than 10. In the 1 milligram group, 18% saw a response and 8% had a remission by week 3. At 12 weeks, at the end of the study period, 20% of the 25 milligram group had a sustained response compared to 5 and 10% of the groups in the 10 milligram and 1 milligram arms, respectively. The average MADRS score change was 12 in the 25 milligram group, whereas the 10 and 1 milligram groups were smaller at 12 weeks, about 7, and the difference was not statistically significant from each other. So basically, they did not seem to have a very large response that was maintained throughout the study period. Of note, the predefined threshold for like a minimal improvement according to clinician evaluation using the MADRS questionnaire is 8 points. So anything less than 8 points, the clinician probably wouldn't be able to pick up reliably. And then as far as patient ratings, if they did this on themselves, it's about 5 points. So how I interpret that is that the 25 milligram group clearly had a big response that would be sufficiently notable in clinical practice, whereas the other two groups maybe not.
Yeah.
Of note, also, the average SSRI effect, so that's probably the most commonly prescribed medication, monotherapy for depression, the average SSRI effect with respect to MADRS scores is about 2.99 points, which is significantly less than what they saw in this. And this is a one-time treatment. It's not like these folks were getting psilocybin once a week. It was once at the beginning of the study, and then they just kind of looked and observed these patients throughout the 12-week study period. So pretty big effect. Other things that are important: the adverse effects. So about two-thirds of the 25 milligram group had an adverse event, about 3/4 of the 10 milligram group had an adverse effect, and over half of the 1 milligram group had an adverse effect after administration of the psilocybin. The most frequently reported adverse effects were headache, nausea, dizziness, and fatigue on the day of administration. So I have not been on a psilocybin journey just yet, so I don't know if that's normal or not, but those were the most commonly reported adverse events. There were additional adverse events reported from weeks 3 to week 12. They were pretty sparse, but the most important ones were the suicidal ideation. Basically, there were individuals in each group that reported an increase in suicidal ideation and suicide-related behavior, but there was a significant amount of suicidal ideation and suicide behavior in baseline in all groups. But you know, the take-home here is that 14% of all of the studied individuals showed a worsening of suicidal ideation. So there, you know, there are no free lunches in biology. So there was some of that going on with the adverse events, but pretty big effect on depression overall. Austin, do you want to talk about some limitations of the study?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that we need to dissect this to death the way we would in a regular journal club kind of context, but I think it's worth mentioning that, again, these kind of medicines and studying them makes it pretty difficult to actually blind people. And so in this paper, one of the big limitations is that they did not actually. So one of the strategies that you can use when studying them is you can actually ask patients in the study, like, what treatment group do you think that you were in? Because then that will tell you, did they unblind themselves in the course of the study? Were they able to figure it out, right? Mm-hmm. Because then that would impact your interpretation of their results, right? So in this study, they did not assess participants' ability to dose to guess their dose assignment. And so, you know, the researchers were not, they're not actually able to say how effective the blinding was in this particular study. And so I'll compare that. There's another pretty recent trial of psilocybin. I guess this is being researched more and more recently, that came up in the context of alcohol use disorder, or and they basically compared similarly. It must have been by the same group because the design was very similar. They also had a specialized playlist and eye shades. So when you mentioned that, I was like, they did that in this other study too. Sure. And so they compared psilocybin and psychotherapy for alcohol use issues compared with psychotherapy and placebo, and they showed a marked reduction in heavy alcohol use, like much a bigger reduction compared to what was seen in psychotherapy plus placebo. But when they looked, they actually assessed, you know, were patients able to guess what treatment group they were in, whether psilocybin or placebo, and like almost 94% of people in that study were able to correctly guess their treatment assignment. So that also kind of makes you wonder, you know, it makes you interpret it a little bit differently when it's like, oh, everybody like immediately figured out what group they were in, whereas that was not assessed in this particular study. So that's like one of the more glaring ones that I see out of this this one relating to depression.
Yeah. And it's not that we're like worried about, oh, were people able to figure out what arm they were in? It's just that, all right, we know that we're getting at least some expectation potentially in the results here and placebo sort of mediated benefit. You know, if people can guess that they're getting a higher dose, they might expect that to work better, for example, and have better outcomes. And so, yeah, you would prefer, if you really wanted to be very confident that a particular intervention, medical intervention worked, that people would not be able to guess at all. That means that your control group, you know, and your intervention groups were, you know, so similar that people couldn't really tell. But, you know, that is one of the limitations here. What I take home from this is that this seems pretty promising. I mean, when you compare the MADRS results, which is again a validated questionnaire used to assess treatment efficacy for depression, that big improvement in the 25 milligram group, bigger than, you know, SSRI data has been to date. That seems pretty great. Even when you consider the side effect profile, yeah, you don't like to see that, you know, a substantial portion of all treatment groups had an adverse effect, particularly the worsening of suicidal ideation. But at the same time, like, there's a black box warning on almost every SSRI I can think of that pertains to suicidal ideation or suicide related behavior, because there's a non-zero portion of the population that's going to get a little worse with an SSRI.
Yeah.
So
yeah, that's why we're supposed to kind of check in and follow up with these patients pretty frequently in the early phase of treatment with those kind of medicines, in case there's somebody who may experience that.
Yeah. But, the way I think about this is that if you were thinking about like what is the most severe type of major depressive disorder, it'd be the treatment resistant ones, mm-hmm. you know, because they basically tried a bunch of stuff, hasn't really worked, and they've kind of persisting in this depressed state. And so that group of folks might have the most to gain here. And so maybe that's why the effect is so big that we're seeing, you know, because
particularly interesting for a one-time thing. I think that's like, you know, pretty unique as far as a lot of medical treatments go, that it's just a one-time thing. And you're, and I mean, it's not to say that you're done indefinitely, but at least as far as the study duration went, like it had, there were a fair number of people who had a sustained effect, which for people who have a, again, by definition, treatment resistant condition is pretty interesting.
Yeah. And they got there by week three and were able to like sustain that. Mm-hmm. I wish I would have done some more review on esketamine, the intranasal ketamine, just to compare the results there, because that's another currently FDA approved treatment for major depressive disorder that is a one-time shot, you know, and seems to work very, very quickly. So yeah, that would have been nice to compare here. But I will be curious to see where the research goes. Again, this is a phase two clinical trial. I expect that the phase three clinical trials will be even larger, probably expand groups to not only just treatment resistant major depressive disorder, but also, you know, as initial monotherapy, for example, just to see how that compares to SSRI, for example.
Yeah. Yeah. And I know I do get the sense that this kind of, whether you call it psychedelic or hallucinogenic or whatever kind of, you know, drug category is being researched more also in other conditions, particularly in the context of PTSD is another place where there's a lot of research into that. That's coming up.
People are going to listen to this and they're going to be like, all right, cool. So I just microdose at home. Is that what you guys are saying? It's like, so no, they weren't microdosing. They weren't taking this on a regular basis. This was like a one-time deal, at least for the study period. And further, like the purity, the dosage, you know, all the stuff that goes into like pharmaceutical development, manufacturing, distribution, etc. I don't know that I trust the ethics of, you know, drug dealers.
Your guy.
yeah, but my guy would never do that. It's like, oh, he's got a mass spec at his place. Like he's just, you know, he's got a PhD in chemistry, you know, and a whole team of people working on every single batch. Yeah. So I'll be curious to see how this develops. This is certainly interesting. It seems at least promising from this standpoint. Guys, go and should we all go invest in Compass Pathfinder to see how they're this is not financial advice. I am not a financial professional, so don't do that. Okay, so that was the first study we reviewed this on this month's research review. Second study is called the comparative effects of low dose rosuvastatin, placebo, and dietary supplements on lipids and inflammatory biomarkers. This is by Laffin et al. This was published in the November issue of the Journal of American College of Cardiology. So again, just from this month. Okay, as far as some background, dyslipidemia is very common. People call this high cholesterol or my cholesterol's out of whack. But yeah, the medical clinical term is dyslipidemia. Its prevalence is increased in patients with premature coronary heart disease, being as high as 75 to 85% compared with approximately 40 to 48% in age-matched controls without coronary heart disease. So basically, if you have elevated cholesterol, your risk of having premature coronary heart disease, or as we've called it on this podcast, atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease, ASCVD, goes up markedly. Okay, Austin, just as a quick review, I know we've done podcasts, you've got a three-part article series on this. What is dyslipidemia, though, if you really want to define it? And then I'm going to, you know, I just used the terms interchangeably, lipids and cholesterol, but we know that's not true. So just give people a lay of the land here quickly.
Yeah, I think probably my spiel that may have mentioned on the podcast before, we are mostly water. There are a lot of biologically active things that don't dissolve in water. These are called lipids. Cholesterol is a form of lipid. And because we are mostly water, yet we need these things that don't dissolve to circulate in our bloodstream, we need special carriers. These are called lipoproteins. Examples of those are low-density lipoprotein, LDL, high-density lipoprotein, HDL, a bunch of others. This gets really complicated really fast, but that's probably sufficient for the you know, 10 million foot overview of this topic. And so the idea here is that we want the trafficking, the transport of these things throughout our body to be, you know, very efficient is a way to think about it. And to the extent that things get kind of backed up, to the extent that we have a lot of lipid of these substances accumulating in our blood circulation that are not being cleared particularly quickly, that can lead to high concentrations in the blood. So high blood levels, that's what comes out on a blood test. And so the higher your levels are and the longer they are high for across the lifespan, then the higher risk that translates into. And so we see people who have extremely high blood cholesterol, blood lipid levels from birth. They have exceptionally high risk of heart attacks and cardiovascular disease early in life. For people who have a more modest elevation, it can take many more years to develop heart disease. So we might see heart attacks in the 60s, 70s kind of time frame. And then some people who are fortunate enough to be able to maintain very low blood lipids among their other risk factors for heart disease over the whole lifespan, then they may go their whole life and not be impacted by this disease process at all. And they may end up, passing away of something else altogether. So that's kind of the short story on it.
Yep. And so why this is a subject of inquiry, about a third of adults in the United States are using some sort of complementary and alternative medicine. Cholesterol is included as one of the top 10 conditions for which adults are using this complementary and alternative medicine. Fish oil and garlic, for example, are two supplements that are commonly used for the reduction of high cholesterol and are among the top 10 most frequently used supplements. We know that reducing lifelong exposure to high cholesterol, high apolipoprotein B containing particles reduces the risk of heart disease. On a standard lipid panel, apolipoprotein B containing particles are approximated by non-HDL cholesterol, the primary component of which is LDL cholesterol. And so when you get your standard lipid panel and it gives you an LDL number, which is calculated, that is, representative from that test as your apolipoprotein B containing fraction of lipids. And so we'd like to get that number lower if it is elevated. So that brings another question. What is a normal LDL cholesterol number? And when would you start treating somebody for that number?
Yeah, this is a complicated question for a few different reasons. There is not really there's a biological gradient, as there are with many things. And what I mean by that is that you can have any number of LDL-C in the blood or LDL, cholesterol value, or any number of these particles. It's a continuous kind of variable, and risk scales with this, continuous spectrum. So risk goes up continuously over the lifespan as these levels go up. And stay high over the lifespan. There is not, as with many things, we artificially kind of break it down or artificially dichotomize it into normal and abnormal, or normal and high, which is really not a great way to do this. And as a result, it has led to a whole bunch of unnecessary confusion. And so I get into the details of this in the part 3 cholesterol article on the website, because there are people who say, for example, they'll look back at some data and they'll say, some big fraction of people who had heart attacks in this study had normal cholesterol levels. And again, it's what is normal? Because we know that once levels get low enough, atherosclerosis halts. It does not progress when your blood lipid levels are low enough. And so the argument could be made that for those who had heart attacks with supposedly normal cholesterol levels, because at one point the normal total cholesterol level was 200 milligrams per deciliter total. Mm-hmm. It is very arguable, and I would in fact argue this, that a total, if we're looking at total, for example, that a total cholesterol level of 200 for, your average person is probably high. Insofar as it is going to impact their lifelong risk. And so I really dislike dichotomizing into artificially, normal and high. I the way we use these numbers is in context of their age and a whole bunch of other kind of risk factors, and try to get a sense of what is their, medium-term risk and what is their lifetime risk, and kind of try to treat accordingly, right? So if I have somebody who has, a moderate elevation, but they're, a teenager, then I'm going to be more concerned about that person, because I know that this moderate elevation is going to really add up, the quote unquote area under the curve over their whole lifespan, right? Whereas if I have somebody who is, 88 years old and they have a moderate elevation and they're, doing their thing, and I'm probably going to be much less aggressive in that kind of a situation, right? So there's a spectrum of these values, and we kind of try to incorporate it into an overall spectrum of risk. And so treatment decisions is a much more complex kind of decision-making process than I can kind of get into here. But the articles that I wrote on the website are one way that can get into the details on that. We also frequently have people either post on our forums or pursue consultations. You know, they'll do a consult with me or something to talk about this, or talk with your doctor about it, and they will very likely be able to help you with it.
Yeah. Yeah, I just think it's important for folks to take away that if you get a standard lipid test, the LDL-C number represents these apolipoprotein B containing particles. And we know that if you were trying to like correlate one value related to lipids and heart disease risk, the amount of apolipoprotein B containing particles, that's like, that's the most predictive number. And you can get that test, that specialty test, in addition to a standard lipid test. But if you just have a standard lipid panel, well, that's your LDL.
Yeah, the easiest way off the standard lipid panel is just to calculate what's called the non-HDL cholesterol. Take the total, subtract HDL, you get a non-HDL. And then if we wanted to really simplify this and reduce it down for people who have no history of heart disease at all, and they're otherwise doing fine, if that non-HDL is less than about 130 milligrams per deciliter, then I'm feeling okay about you.
But you prefer it to be like 70 or 50.
Well, I mean, we know that populations who have you could obliterate all risk of heart disease if you got levels down that low, but that's just unfeasible for most people in our modern environment to do that. So, and then for people who have a history of heart disease, then it's a whole different calculus. And we do try to get it down as low as possible to reduce their risk of having another kind of heart attack or stroke or whatever they had.
Yep. Yeah. They're basically more predisposed to having a bad outcome unless they get that thing down and get it down now, because again, just over time.
Lifespan exposure.
Yep, exactly. Okay, so this study was of interest because we just want to know, what does the evidence say on how these supplements work? Because people are taking all this stuff. They're taking garlic, cinnamon, friggin' turmeric, red yeast rice extract. All right, so let's talk about this actual study. This is a double-blinded randomized controlled trial. They had 199 subjects. The average age was 63.3. The median LDL cholesterol level was 128. It actually had to be between 70 and 189. Basically, if it was higher than that, they're like, ooh, you probably need to be treated with some additional medication depending on your actual risk. And if it was lower than 70, they were like, yeah, so we don't expect any of this stuff to actually work because your LDL cholesterol level is low, and you're good to go. They could have no personal history of heart disease. They could not currently be on statins or any other lipid-lowering therapy, and they could not be taking any of the supplements within the trial already. So they got randomized to one of the following interventions: 5 milligrams of rosuvastatin, which listeners might know as Crestor, and that is a baby dose. That is like a breath of Crestor, like a burp of Crestor. So not the actual dose is usually like 30, 40 milligrams, I think, for like...
Well, the highest intensity would be usually upwards of 40 milligrams, which would be used for the highest risk patients. But, you know, for people who are, you know, not super, super high risk and I want to use this medicine for them, then 5 or 10 milligrams is not unusual for me to use, for reasons that will become clear when we talk about what it did in this study.
Yeah, exactly. Or they got placebo, or they got fish oil, 2,400 milligrams of fish oil, or they got cinnamon, 2,400 milligrams. I assume that was a capsule. Like, they didn't actually say that in the study, but I assume they weren't
not
just
chewing
like,
on sticks.
Oh my gosh. Or they took garlic that had 5,000 micrograms of allicin. Or they took turmeric with curcumin and bioperine, 4,500 milligrams of that. Or they took plant sterols, 1,600 milligrams. And you note that the dosage here was a little low for what plant sterols are normally dosed at. What is the normal dose for plant sterols? Do you know of him?
Well, so there's a bunch of different kinds. Basically, plant sterols are kind of like cholesterol are for us, but the plant version. And so there is evidence for sure, and we'll get into this a little bit later as well, that supplementing the diet with plant sterols, or as they're sometimes known as phytosterols, in that they come from plants, can reduce blood cholesterol levels. There's some complex mechanisms in the gut with how they mess with absorption and excretion of certain cholesterol, things like that. And so there are multiple different kinds, but definitely I think that insofar as it is possible to see a lipid lowering effect from them, you would see a stronger effect from a higher dose than was given in the study.
And they finally, the last arm of this was the red yeast rice extract. This they took 2,400 milligrams of that. And if you've listened to a couple of our previous podcasts where we talk about red yeast rice extract, the active ingredient there it's a number of types of monocholins, particularly monocholin K, which was the same active ingredient in lovastatin. In any case, it basically that got pulled from the market because lovastatin was already on the market as a prescription drug. And so red yeast rice extract was kind of banned. Although if you go on Amazon or wherever, you can find this stuff, and we'll talk about why maybe that's not the greatest idea if you're trying to treat elevated cholesterol numbers. And so what do they do? They basically took a fasting lipid panel, a complete metabolic panel, and a high sensitive C-reactive protein at the beginning and the end of the study. And it was basically a month long, 28 days. Austin, just briefly, what is a high sensitivity C-reactive protein, and when would you obtain this?
Yeah, so this is a blood test that in broad strokes is what we call a non-specific marker of inflammation. It is something that has some interesting origins, why it's called C-reactive protein and things like that. There's some backstory because it was observed to be elevated in certain kinds of infections, but in general, it's not specific for infection. It's more of just anything that causes increases in inflammation. And we know from other data in the research world of heart disease that patients who have high levels of inflammation, they're at higher risk of having heart, cardiovascular events, heart attacks, strokes, things like that, compared with people who have lower levels of inflammation. And just to tack on one thing here is that some folks will say cholesterol doesn't matter at all. It is actually the inflammation. And this is something I also address in part three of the cholesterol article series on the website. There are data that basically look at four kinds of patients. Patients who have high LDL levels, high cholesterol and high inflammation, who have low cholesterol and high inflammation, who have high cholesterol and low inflammation, and then who have low levels of both. And the spectrum pans out pretty much exactly as you would expect. People who have high levels of both are at the highest risk. People who have low levels of both are at the lowest risk. And people who have, one way or the other on either variable, they fall somewhere in between. Mm-hmm. So it actually appears that both of these things matter. And so that's kind of what this protein is and why it would be measured. There's also other research on pharmaceutical, medication interventions and lifestyle interventions and that specifically aimed at lowering this and their impact on heart disease risk, which, have some mixed results. And then, the study you said on day zero and day 28, which some might say, is that too short? And honestly, I would say no. Particularly right. For, when I initiate somebody on some form of, cholesterol lowering or lipid lowering therapy like rosuvastatin, or if they make a very radical lifestyle change, it is unsurprising to me. Like, I'm happy to recheck blood lipids in 4 weeks, in the 4 to 6 week range, and I expect to see a pretty substantial impact from that by that time point. It does not take like 6 months for these things to manifest or to maximize.
Yeah. But if you were going to evaluate hard outcomes like major adverse cardiac event or heart attack or something like that, you'd want to follow them for
years. You'd have to have a much bigger trial and follow it for much longer. Exactly. Yep.
Okay. So what happened in the study? So adherence was high. Only 4 participants out of the 199 took less than 70% of the assigned doses of whatever supplement or medication they were randomized to. As far as what it did to the LDL cholesterol level, rosuvastatin lowered LDL cholesterol by 37.9%. Placebo lowered cholesterol by 2.6%. Fish oil lowered cholesterol by 3.4%. Cinnamon increased cholesterol by 0.4%, basically stayed the same. Garlic increased cholesterol by 5.1%. Not looking good for the old garlic here. Turmeric and curcumin with biopurine decreased cholesterol by 1.3%, and plant sterols decreased cholesterol by 4.4%. The red yeast rice extract decreased cholesterol by 6.6%, which again is a fraction of the 37.9% that rosuvastatin lowered cholesterol by. And again, you would actually expect red yeast rice extract to do better. It's like, look, if it's got that monacolin K in it, which is the active ingredient in lovastatin, and it's got enough of it in there, whew, should be doing some work. The problem is that when you actually look at, how much monocolon K is in the red yeast rice extract, you actually take a bunch of different preparations of red yeast rice extract and test how much monocolon K is in them. The content ranges all over the map from 0.1 milligrams per capsule up to 10 milligrams per capsule. So you don't really know what you're getting, because again, this is a supplement that's not supposed to be being sold right now, yet, some unscrupulous distributors are still in fact selling it. And further, 4 of the preparations, when they actually tested the monocolon K content, had elevated levels of citrullin, which is a potentially nephrotoxic mycotoxin, so a toxin made from fungus. 10 out of 10, would not recommend. As far as total cholesterol levels, rosuvastatin lowered total cholesterol by 24.4%, whereas all others had less than a 3% effect on total cholesterol. With respect to triglycerides, rosuvastatin lowered triglycerides by 19.3%, and all others had less than a 5% effect on triglycerides. And in fact, cinnamon and Reggie's rice extract actually raised triglycerides. And high sensitivity C-reactive protein, rosuvastatin reduced that value by 5.7%, whereas none of the other supplements had statistically significant reductions comparatively. So looks like a big win for rosuvastatin and a big L for everything else. And I don't know that I would recommend, attempting to take that L if I was recommending folks to try to manage this. So yeah, I liked that they were basically did the study that we all wanted to see. Like, all right, well, how does rosuvastatin or an actual statin medication at a low dose actually compare to some of these other things? Fish oil, cinnamon, garlic, turmeric. Because people ask about this stuff all the time. Like, well, I heard about curcumin or turmeric or biopurine. Or like, what if I took them all together? Would that be like akin to taking a low dose statin? Answer, no.
Not even a little bit.
Not even close. That's the other thing, right? It's like definitively now we can say like we would not expect marked changes in any parameter we care about related to lipids by taking those supplements. We talked a little bit about the plant sterol limitation. You wanna go into some more detail here?
Yeah, so there's a couple things about this. One thing that I'll mention first is you mentioned earlier when you were citing the results, you were mentioning like the point estimates, basically like the average value that was changed for each of those subjects. But there are error bars around all of those. Mm-hmm. And effectively for all the supplements, none of them, when you account, for the statistical comparison, showed any significant improvement over the placebo. And so I really liked one of the, data outputs from this that showed individual subject level changes, which I've mentioned before, is one of my favorite things to see in studies, particularly like when we look at strength training, resistance training research, is what happened to each individual person in the study. Did they get better? Did they get worse? What happened? And so even in the placebo group, so I shared this this graph on my story this week because it was very striking. When you look at the placebo group, there's a whole range. Some people from start to finish had a substantial decrease in cholesterol. Some people had no change. Some people had an increase in cholesterol. This is just typical, expected, normal biological variability. And then when you look at every single supplement, it's the same pattern. Some people decreased. Some people didn't change. Some people increased. And then when you look at the rosuvastatin group, everybody decreased and everybody decreased markedly. And it's like, yeah, the medicine that hits the pathway that we know, regulates this blood level, it works. And none of these other things did that reliably. However, what's interesting to think about is like, when I looked at that graph showing individual subject level things, I could look at each bar, right? And I could look at that and imagine it as an individual person. And imagine the person who took one of the supplements and happened to be the person whose level went down. Mm-hmm. It's like, I could see that person, of course, coming to the conclusion, quote, it worked for me. And then mm-hmm. they go and they start sharing this information, right? When we saw the exact same pattern happen in the placebo group. So no, it did not, in fact, work for you. It probably did nothing. You could have taken nothing or any of these other things, and you may well have seen the same exact effect just because of, whatever normal random biological variability, or perhaps you inadvertently made some kind of lifestyle change over the course of the study or whatever the case is that led levels to decrease independent of what you were taking. So like if none of these other things did much better than the placebo group, then no, it didn't work for you. Just in the same way that if your levels went up, it probably didn't cause you harm either for the most part, unless we had stronger data showing that compared to placebo, levels reliably went, significantly higher, right? Mm-hmm. So that's kind of how I would interpret that and just caution people about these kind of things because of how easy it would be to extrapolate your individual experience and say, well, it worked for me, so there you go. It's like, well, maybe a little more complicated than that.
Yeah. I really liked their take home. This is a direct quote from the paper. In the single center prospective randomized single blind clinical trial of patients with elevated LDL cholesterol and increased 10-year ASCVD risk, a low dose statin taken daily lowered LDL-C significantly more than placebo, fish oil, cinnamon, garlic, turmeric, plant sterols, and red yeast rice. No supplements significantly lowered LDL-C compared with placebo. No supplement demonstrated a change in other lipid or inflammatory biomarkers suggestive of potential cardiovascular benefit compared with placebo. And it's like, boom, nail in coffin, end of story. I'm not saying we don't need to study this any further because, you would prefer
I think it's fine to just like set red yeast rice aside, kick it out. It like there's no given that the active ingredient of red yeast rice is effectively a statin. And you're choosing to take a supplement that is just an unregulated statin and you don't have an idea of how much you're taking, what the dose is, then it could be contaminated. There's literally no reason to do that. It's not better just because it sounds natural. Just throw it away. Right? Yeah. The plant sterol thing, again, as I mentioned, there is some evidence that they can lower blood cholesterol levels. However, I generally don't recommend them for any of my patients. There's a fraction of the population, I've talked about this before, who are kind of hyper absorbers of sterols from the diet, be it cholesterol or these plant sterols. And people who absorb too much of these into their circulation, it is actually associated with higher rates of cardiovascular disease, taking these plant sterols or phytosterols. There's a weird genetic condition called cytosterolemia or phytosterolemia. These are people who have genetic mutations in certain transporters in their gut, and they just like suck all this stuff up, and then it all goes straight into plaques in their vasculature. So I don't recommend plant sterols. I don't recommend red yeast rice. And then now we have evidence also that these other things, garlic, turmeric, you know, cinnamon, et cetera, are not going to have the kind of impact that we're looking for on blood lipid levels. And you literally can take a whiff of something like rosuvastatin. I mean, 2.5 milligrams, 5 milligrams, and get a pretty substantial lipid-lowering effect. And the idea, and I do this all the time in practice, is those very low dose treatments, they come with the lowest risk of experiencing the side effects that people are worried about. And if I want to get an even bigger effect while minimizing the risk of side effects, there's also evidence on this, combining multiple low dose rosuvastatin, 2.5, 5, 10, something like that, with something like ezetimibe, 10 milligrams. That's also something that is extremely well tolerated. And there's evidence basically showing that people, despite it being two pills instead of one, actually are able to stick to it better. They discontinue it less and they get a bigger blood lipid lowering effect compared to taking super high doses of statins. So for just people who are not ultra high risk, like who've had heart attacks before, who unfortunately just really should be on the highest doses if they can tolerate them. For people who are not in that situation, but who need to get their levels down using, you know, medication therapy, I am definitely biased towards using low doses of combination treatment to get that down rather than maximize cranking up the dose of one as much as somebody can tolerate before considering anything else.
Yeah. And I want to be clear, like neither of us would recommend taking a statin or other medication to lower lipids, you know, in isolation without also trying to address physical activity, dietary pattern, lifestyle, et cetera.
All the things that are in the cholesterol article, part two, I believe, tackles all that stuff. What to do with your diet, what to do with your lifestyle, et cetera. Yep.
Yeah. Why not both?
Yep. Exactly.
If you need it. Cool. All right. So that paper is linked in the description below, as with all of our other resources. Again, this is episode 199 with Dr. Austin Baracki. This is our November 2022 research review, and our third and final paper for this research review is the validity and reliability of facial rating of perceived exertion scales for training load monitoring. This was by Vanderswoord and his research group from the Netherlands. This was published in the Journal of Strength Conditioning Research. This was actually from October of 2022. So I misspoke earlier saying that all of these papers were from November. This one was actually from last month, but still very, very recent. Okay, Baracki, do you remember the first time that you were training and you noticed that your eyeballs were popping out of their sockets?
I don't know that I noticed it myself.
You like took a video. You're like, bro, that is some severe exophthalmos. Like, what is going on? Okay. So basically some background here. RPE, you guys know that we use RPE or rating of perceived exertion to not only measure how hard a particular task was, like a particular set of an exercise. So you squatted 5 reps. How hard was it, using a scale 1 to 10? And often, but not always, that proxy is related to the repetitions left in reserve. So RPE 8 would be 2 reps left in reserve. RPE 9 would be 1 rep left in reserve. RPE 10 would be 0 reps left in reserve. We also use RPE scale for rating how hard an entire workout was. And we usually use the 1 to 10 scale, 10 being that was a really hard workout, 1 being that didn't really do anything at all, and everything in between. You can formulate an RPE scale using any sort of terms, values, pictures, descriptions that you want. As far as the validity of that scale, well, that's to be determined. You'd have to test that on a substantially or significantly sized sample size and then, you know, report your findings. So yeah. usually for rating training load or monitoring training load, you're looking more at session RPE ratings and duration and how that changes over time. Typically, when this has been studied in the literature, they use either the Borg RPE scale, which is rated from 6 to 20, or a modified version of that scale, which ranges from 1 to 10. That's what we use. In this particular study, they were trying to figure out if we add facial emoticons, so the stuff on your iPhone or other smartphone, you know, smiley face, frowny face, red frowny face, like, did that actually add anything or make it easier for people to rate these things more accurately and therefore give a better insight into what the actual training load was? Now, before we get into this, when I first read the title, I go, they're just videoing these people and look at it like their facial strain. Like, were they grimacing? Did they have exophthalmos? Or their eyes popping out of their socket? Did they have like any sort of other sort of discernible facial features? I was looking forward to seeing some pictures of people at the bottom of the squat or something or like that. It's just like, what did their face look like? But they didn't. This was all about emojis. But as far as eye stuff, just because we are talking about Baraki's eyes, and I'll link the April Fool's post in the description below. It's pretty humorous. Hopefully no one's reading that and not looking at the date and being like, this is serious. But it's a 1 to 10 scale with Baraki's face in different shades of red and grimace. And I think the actual 10, I had to pump the red up
so, a little bit.
Yeah. Oh my gosh. Yeah, if that was your real face, 10 out of 10 would recommend clinical workup on that. But yeah, stuff can happen to your eyes when you train. I was just more curious, like, what would happen since we were talking about Baraki's eyes. There are a few different interesting case reports on what happens to the eyes during training. So one thing that's been reported in the literature is called orbital emphysema. And I know what people are thinking, well, emphysema, that's lung stuff. How does the lung stuff get to the eye stuff? That doesn't make any sense. So yeah, basically you can have a fracture or otherwise rupture of the bony skeleton surrounding your eye. That's called the orbit, and free air gets into either the bone and or muscular tissues or soft tissues around the eye or even the eye itself. And so free air goes into one or more of these structures. This all often happens during an orbital fracture due to trauma, or this can happen during vigorous nose blowing. It is the season. So if you're a vigorous nose blower, you know, and your eye starts swelling up and you get a bunch of pain every time you touch it, maybe go get that checked out. Anyway, there was a 23-year-old dude who had a sudden left periorbital swelling. So the area around his left eye got really swollen after lifting weights. And the picture they had on this guy in the case report, dear God. I mean, that's one of those things, though. Yeah, if that happened, I'd be like, I'm going to the hospital.
Total freak accident.
Yeah. And basically, he had orbital emphysema. He had crepitus and swelling in the periorbital area and 10 out of 10 pain to palpation. So basically, his eye just huge, swollen, super tender and painful. And yeah, they gave him antibiotics just to make sure there was no like infection that seeded the area. They observed him and it completely resolved by 3 days. So, you know,
cool.
I don't know if he was back to lifting weights on day four, but yeah, his discharge photo, he looked completely normal. Handsome dude. Another thing that's been reported with weightlifting is called purpura retinopathy. This is sudden visual loss after trauma due to retinal hemorrhages. So, basically some of the vasculature in the eye either ruptures or there's some sort of issue related to blood flow to the eye. This can happen from a clot being thrown from a long bone fracture or compressive injuries of the trunk or rapid deceleration of the head. So if you've got a potentially like a motorcycle crash, for example, all of these things have been reported. It's usually bilateral, actually, not just unilateral. But this guy was a 17-year-old male. Yeah, with the sudden loss of left eye vision after weightlifting. And they were like, maybe this is due to Valsalva. But interestingly, they didn't do anything. They just basically ruled out everything else and said, we'll observe you. And it resolved on its own. So interesting, but not really related to this study. Yeah. But I went down that rabbit hole. Just briefly, as far as what does exercise do to like ocular physiology? Basically, there's no robust data on exercise and eye disease. So when people are like, what does exercise do to glaucoma? What does exercise do to retinal detachment? What does exercise do with cataracts, et cetera? So basically all of the longitudinal data sets that we have on those common eye diseases do not report physical activity levels. So we just
don't really know, even like correlational data, like, oh, people who exercise more had less incidence of glaucoma, or they're less sort of events related to glaucoma, for example. We know that like the intraocular pressure, so the pressure within the eyeball, tends to go down during dynamic exercise. So that's locomotive type stuff, running, walking, cycling, swimming, rowing, etc. But intraocular pressure goes up during isometric activity, like hand grip for something, or if you were bracing right before a squat. And so in resistance training, intraocular pressure goes up a bunch, not only because your blood pressure is up, goes up, as it does with all forms of exercise, but also because you're doing a Valsalva. Interestingly, the more fit someone is, the less, the lower the actual increase is in intraocular pressure. But this is concerning for folks who have glaucoma, which has been described as like ocular hypertension or ocular high blood pressure. The outcomes of like resistance training, weightlifting, or intense exercise on glaucoma, not really sure that there's any effect. But there are higher rates of physical inactivity in those with glaucoma. And so whether that's correlational, whether that's causal, we don't really know. But I definitely have had a DM conversation or multiple DM conversations with people who have either a client with glaucoma, a family member with glaucoma, or they personally have it. And they're like, can I lift? And I'm like, I mean, there are risks to being insufficiently active, and those are well studied. There are benefits to meeting or exceeding the physical activity guidelines. Those are well documented. And we just don't know what happens with the actual disease process of glaucoma with respect to exercise. It just doesn't appear like it modifies the disease process much itself. And certainly I would expect if there was this big risk of like bad outcomes with glaucoma, we would see a signal in the literature. It's kind of the same way I feel about pregnancy and exercise, right? If there was like this huge risk of exercise on, you know, bad outcomes during pregnancy, particularly since a lot of people have gotten into high intensity exercise via CrossFit and other sort of forms recently, we would see a signal, a bunch of case reports like, you know, person had, you know, worsening glaucoma during from exercise. And it's like, yeah, we don't see any of that.
Yeah. So I wonder a couple other things. I mean, glaucoma is quite treatable in general. There's a lot of medications that are used for it. There's some other procedural stuff that, you know, ophthalmologists do that is beyond what I what I am very familiar with.
No tonometer.
And then additionally, as we've talked about in other contexts, like I do also, I can't help but wonder if it's one of those situations as well, similar to, you know, high regular blood pressure, if it matters how you got there, not just 100%. What the pressure is, right? If you got there because you're sitting on your couch and you just have glaucoma, and that's, you know, your pressure in your eye is going up versus via exercise. So I suspect that there's probably a difference based on how you got there too. So
yeah, there was one study where they compared intraocular pressure during a bench press. They were lying down versus a standing squat, and it was higher in the bench press. I guess just like blood pooling in the head. So like positional kind of thing. But yeah, in any case, probably the biggest risk to like bad eye stuff happening from exercise has to do with sports injuries. You just think about racket sports, trauma. Yeah. And in the United States, particularly due to the participation rates, large ball sports, baseball, football, soccer, et cetera, just people not wearing eyewear and then getting smacked in the eye. Or if you're like me, you know, and you're just golfing and, you take a ball to the eye, not a great experience. 10 out of 10 would not recommend. Okay. So enough on that aside, let's get back to the study. So this study was basically done to evaluate the validity of a 5 and 10 point facial RPE scales as compared to the 10 point session RPE scale. So again, this is not like reps in reserve. This is more like a global rating of how hard the session was, using a 1 to 10 scale, 10 being the hardest, 1 being the easiest. So they had 61 individuals, 44 women, 17 men, and they rated 12 workout sessions, over 6 to 7 weeks. 17 were untrained, 19 were deemed recreationally trained, and 12 were trained based on power output. And how they tested this is they put them on the cyclergometer, which was called Excalibur, which, looks a lot like that Monarch Wingate bike that we had in my garage. They basically just had them do this test to see like what their power output was and then stratified them into untrained, recreationally trained, or trained. They asked these individuals to rate their perceived exertion for the entire training session by asking them how was their workout. And they used one of three scales. They either used this 10-point facial recognition scale, a 5-point facial recognition scale or the standard 1 to 10. And I got the visual put up here. It's in the paper that's that I've linked also. So the 10 point is basically like, again, just 0 to 10. 0 is rest. 10 is maximal, and then every value in between. So 1 is really easy, 3 is moderate, 7 is really hard, 9 is really, really hard, and again, 10 is maximal. The 5-point facial recognition scale basically uses 5 different emojis. It's got the smiley face, which reminds me of Tom Campitelli. That's easy. The number two is the emoji with the flat smile, and that's sort of hard. The third ranking of 3 is the slight frowny face emoji. Number 4 is a frowny face with, I guess it's like a
grimace kind of.
Yeah. And then 5 is like the very angry grimace, and yeah, also color-coded dark red. And the 10 point facial recognition scale is an expanded version of that. It's just instead of 1 to 5, it's 1 to 10, but same emojis. So after basically they've did again 12 total sessions during this period, they either use the 1 to 10 scale, the 5-point facial recognition scale, or the 10-point facial recognition scale. These workouts were home-based. They were all bodyweight exercises. They had low, medium, and high intensity workouts. All of the different study groups, so untrained, recreationally trained, and trained, got exposed to all of the different intensities. They also monitored their heart rate to try to see what the correlation was between heart rate and these facial recognition sort of ratings. And yet they used a random sequence of intensity. So it wasn't just like low, medium, hard, low, medium, hard. It was all over the place. So what did they find? Yeah. So they basically compared the results to this 1 to 10 scale. That's the gold standard. It's been validated in a number of different data sets. They used this term called the intra-class correlation coefficient, which basically measures the reliability of their exertion ratings compared to this gold standard. We don't need to go into the details here, but the higher the value, they usually range from 0 to 1, the higher the value, the more closely, you know, whatever new scale you're using compares to the gold standard. So if you had a intra-class correlation coefficient, an ICC value of 0.9, you're like, oh, that's pretty good. And if it was 0.1, you'd be like, pretty bad. All right. So what did they find? There, across all groups and workouts, there was a moderate agreement with the 5-point facial recognition scale. And a good agreement, so slightly higher, 0.75 of the 10-point facial recognition scale as compared to the regular 1 to 10 scale without the emoticons. There was a slight bias towards a higher RPE rating with the 5-point scale. It also appeared that there was some poor validity in the 5 and the 10-point facial recognition scale for untrained, so people who had not exercised that much before or weren't very fit, but it was pretty good in recreational and the trained groups. In fact, for the 10-point facial or emoji containing RPE scale, the ICC value was 0.8 and 0.85 for the recreational and the trained groups, respectively. The correlation for these scales and the heart rate was not that good, just overall not that good, but that's not really the point. We're not really using these subjective RPE sort of scales to correlate to heart rate, which again is just one of many values that kind of go into how hard a particular exercise session was. As far as what users preferred, it looks like a third of them preferred the 5-point facial emoji containing scale. A third favored the 10 point facial emoji containing scale, and a third favored the regular 1 to 10 scale. So kind of all over the place. It is interesting to me, this paper kind of came to the conclusion like, yeah, you can use this if people are trained, recreationally trained or well-trained, because my takeaway was something completely different. It's like, it doesn't really matter what the value is that you get that it spit out here at the end of, you know, it's like, okay, they ranked the session RPE as 4 and that correlated to this emoji. I don't really care. I just want to use the same scale over and over and over again, and kind of whatever the preferred tool was, that seemed to be the one that correlated the best. And that's what I would use as a coach, right? If I was trying to get someone to use session RPE and they were like, I don't get this 1 to 10, it doesn't make any sense to me, I might use one with emojis. Yeah. Just because maybe they identify with that a little bit better. Or if all of our templates came with like emoji scales and they were like, I don't get the emojis don't make any sense. I would just use a 1 to 10 scale or 1 to 5 scale. Because again, I'm not really looking at like, what are the actual numbers? I'm more just like, did you rate every session a 5 or a 10, you know? And like, how does that change over time? And so, you know, I think it's useful to have some session RPE data if you're trying to figure out like, am I applying too high of a dose, too much training stress, something like that. And I'd like to keep it consistent. And I'd like people to use a system that they feel comfortable with and understand that shared language that we're trying to develop between coach and client. So do we need emojis?
There could be issues. I mean, there could be issues with literacy, with numeracy, with cross-cultural communication, depending on how the kind of client that you're trying to coach. If you're a coach, they may be, you know, from a different culture, they may have never exercised before, whatever the case is. And so, you know, this actually could be something like this could be a valid tool to try to communicate the, you know, the effort that you are seeking. And again, it's like similar to a lot of the time our conversation in like most people who are training, the absolute, you know, accuracy of their RPE ratings are much less important compared to consistent use kind of over time. Like, I do not think it's worth agonizing over whether that was a 7 or a 7.5 or something.
Yeah.
I don't even bother getting to that level of granularity myself in my own training. I'm like, yeah, that was probably about hard enough.
Close enough. And yet, I think if emojis help people get to the hard enough or prevent them from going too hard, then that's a win. And if the emojis are a distraction, let's go emojiless. But you know, maybe some of our new templates will have we'll have emojis baked in. I just wonder how that open. Like, what if you don't update your phone, and so like the thing pops up as like the question mark?
I think emojis are pretty much here to stay at this point. I think that's unlikely to be an issue.
Yeah. Maybe I'll come up with some different ones. I'll make a Baraki exertion scale. It's just emojis. Like the 10 is going to be the devil guy. Very cool. All right. Anything else you want to leave people with, Dr. B?
Nothing for now. I think we're both excited to get back on the seminar circuit here starting this upcoming weekend, and we'll have some new content from that coming so people can look out for that.
That's right. So this has been episode 199 of the Barbell Medicine Podcast, where we bring modern medicine to strength conditioning and strength conditioning to modern medicine. This has been the November 2022 research review. Special thanks to Dr. Austin Baraki for joining us here this evening. Before you guys go anywhere, please leave us a 5-star rating and a review. It really helps drive traffic to our podcast so we keep bringing you all the latest nuance in health and fitness. We'll catch you next week and every week right here on the Barbell Medicine Podcast. See you.